Episode 88, The Battle of Antietam and the Emancipation Proclamation. Hi, my name is Clayton Mills. Welcome to A Short Walk Through Our Long History, a podcast where we look at the events of history and examine how those events shaped our modern world. Well, the war, the Civil War, has been going pretty well for the South at the midpoint of 1862, but the South has less men, less guns, less cannons, less of almost everything, less manufacturing capacity for sure. But time is sort of on the South's side. The longer that the Confederacy exists as its own country, the more people are likely to just accept it that way. It's its own thing. It's finally done. And the longer the war drags on, especially if the North keeps losing, the more likely the Northern public is to stop supporting the war. Again, kind of like the Revolutionary War, the South doesn't have to win necessarily. It just needs to not lose, or at least not lose catastrophically, and it will keep existing. The North, on the other hand, needs to win decisively. And they haven't done that yet. They haven't really beaten and destroyed a Southern army, even though they won a few battles. The South is still fielding competent armies and still continuing to exist. The North really needs a big win to change the momentum of the war and to change public opinion. But instead, what they get is a Stonewall Jackson victory and another defeat at Bull Run, and then a Confederate invasion of Maryland. In a series of battles up and down the valleys of West Virginia, particularly in the strategic Shenandoah Valley, Stonewall Jackson led a smallish Confederate army that consistently beat the Union forces it encountered. And the fact that there was this successful, dangerous army in the Shenandoah Valley meant that the Union had to be worried about the safety of Washington, D.C. The Shenandoah Valley runs kind of from the northeast to the southwest, slanting up to the right if you're looking at a map. The northeast end of the valley is only about 80 miles from Washington, D.C. And also, just to clear up a misconception that has been foisted upon us by John Denver, the Shenandoah River, which is right in the middle of the Shenandoah Valley, is not in West Virginia. It's firmly in Virginia itself, although it is on the west side of Virginia. So maybe John Denver's singing about the western part of Virginia, not about West Virginia, the state, when he's singing Take Me Home, Country Roads. Also, since we're on that topic, the Blue Ridge Mountains are also in Virginia, not in West Virginia. But again, they are on the west side of Virginia. So, you know, maybe that's what he's talking about. Anyway, the Confederates used the Shenandoah Valley in Virginia like the squirrels use my backyard fence as a highway. Stonewall Jackson drove the Union Army out in June, and with McClellan still recovering from the 7 Days campaign, the Union was struggling. The Union sent out another army, a smaller army, to capture Manassas and its railroads. They tried again at Manassas. This army was commanded by Union General John Pope. Now Lee, because of the spy network, was aware of General Pope's movements, and he sent Stonewall Jackson and General James Longstreet to cut him off. Jackson arrived first, and he set up his forces behind a high railroad embankment that was a bit northwest of the original battlefield at Bull Run, Manassas. Pope moved in and began to engage the Confederate forces. In a battle that lasted 2 days, the Confederates consistently outmaneuvered and surprised the larger Union force and inflicted a huge number of casualties. At the end of the second day, Pope and the army collapsed and, in a somewhat controlled retreat, headed back to Washington. This second battle of Bull Run was another resounding Confederate win, this one attributed basically to Stonewall Jackson. There were almost 14,000 casualties for the North versus about 7,000 for the South. Plus, the South still held the field, and there was no actual army on the ground between the Southern armies and Washington. So on September 7th of 1862, Lee marched his combined armies out of Virginia into Maryland near the town of Frederick. Lee's plans were pretty bold. He hoped to move the field of battle out of Virginia and into Union territory, and he was hoping to defeat the Army of the Potomac and threaten Washington, and perhaps even convince Maryland, the state, which was a slave state, to leave the Union and join the Confederacy. It was an ambitious plan. Now Lee, in a risky move, divided his forces and sent some to try to capture the road junction at Harper's Ferry. That's the same Harper's Ferry where John Brown attacked back in episode 83. After a couple of Union-held towns in Virginia and Maryland had been captured, Lincoln ordered McClellan to get his army out of Washington and do something. McClellan responded, but of course, McClellan responded slowly. Lee, who had captured Frederick, Maryland, moved out of the town and moved to the north. And on September 7th, Union forces reoccupied the town. Now, just outside of Frederick, they found a bundle of 4 cigars that were wrapped in paper that just happened to have Lee's instructions to one of his commanders. That's what the paper was that was wrapped around the cigars, and it detailed how Lee had split his forces. Now, these instructions were, of course, brought back quickly to McClellan, who finally felt like he had the inside info he needed to attack. He moved his army into position to attack Lee. But Lee, knowing that McClellan was coming, and knowing that McClellan's army was much bigger, moved his forces back together and positioned them on a bit of a ridge behind a small creek known as Antietam Creek. In a bit of irony, Antietam Creek runs from, of all places, Gettysburg, Pennsylvania. And it runs past, again ironically, Harper's Ferry, and eventually into the Potomac. A lot of blood has been shed on the banks of Antietam Creek. McClellan had about 87,000 troops. That's a lot of troops. That's the biggest army that had ever been sent to battle in America, in all of American history. Lee had about half of that, about 45,000 troops. The Union was better equipped, better fed, better supplied, but the South was better led. This is about to be the largest battle ever in America, though it won't hold that title for all that long. In fact, only until next episode. On September 17th, 1862, McClellan committed about 3/4 of his troop to the battle, many under the direct command of General Joseph Hooker. Hooker attacks the Confederate left, the Union right, but guess who is holding that line? Stonewall Jackson. Yeah, no, Hooker, sorry, you're not going to move him at all. On the other side of the line, the Union left, they captured and crossed this thing called the Stone Bridge, and they began to break up the Confederate line, but then they were driven back by a fierce counterattack from Confederate General A.P. Hill. Attacks and counterattacks happened all day on the 17th. It was the single biggest engagement of men in the war, and the end results showed it. At the end of the day, the Confederates still held their ground, but there were so many casualties on the Confederate side that Lee and Jackson were forced to withdraw the next day back to Virginia. Now, the actual battle itself was a draw, with neither side winning or defeating the other, neither side controlling the battlefield. But there were just so many casualties on both sides that neither side could really fight on. September 17th, 1862, was the single bloodiest day in U.S. history. The Battle of Antietam claimed over 23,000 casualties, more than Shiloh, which had been 2 days long. The number of dead was over 3,600. Both armies were broken by the conflict. McClellan pulled his forces together and retreated back to Washington, and Lee returned to Virginia. The carnage and violence of that one single day is hard to comprehend. The actual battle was, again, a draw. But in this case, since Lee had invaded Maryland and now was forced to withdraw to Virginia, the North took this to be a huge victory, despite having lost actually a lot more men than the South had. Of course, the North had a lot more men to lose, having had an army that was nearly double the size of the South's. So in terms of the actual cost, it was more costly battle for the South. But Lincoln and a lot of other people felt that McClellan was to blame for the battle not being a total victory, a total defeat for Lee's army. There's a famous picture of Lincoln visiting McClellan in the general's tent on the battlefield. You can find it on Wikipedia. You can just feel the tension between the two. After the battle, Lincoln relieved McClellan of command of the Army of the Potomac. And Lincoln wasn't the only one who felt that McClellan had been too slow. General Henry Halleck, who was on paper the head of all the Union forces, said after the battle, "The long inactivity of so large an army in the face of a defeated foe, and during the most favorable season for rapid movements and a vigorous campaign, was a matter of great disappointment and regret." So Halleck supported Lincoln's removal of McClellan. Again, it seems like McClellan was never really fighting to win. He was fighting to not lose, which is what happened at Antietam. But the Union needed to actually win, and they really didn't. Despite this, Lincoln and the press in the North presented this as a great Union victory, which, as I said, they desperately needed. And as I said, it was really a draw, but it was such a costly draw that everyone just kind of went home afterwards. And because of that, Lee had to leave and move back to Virginia, which ended the invasion, so the Union could sort of count it as a victory. When the Union Army returned to Washington, Lee removed McClellan from its command, and he replaced him with General Burnsides, who is famous for his sideburns. It's actually where the word comes from. Burnsides, despite his facial hair, is not going to last long in this position either. But we'll hear again from George McClellan, whose dislike for Lincoln was fanned into outright hatred after his dismissal. It's not like he didn't deserve the demotion. He had just taken an army that was almost twice as big as the Confederate army and led it into what was essentially a very costly draw. But since Antietam was being presented in the North as a big victory, Lincoln felt like he had the momentum he needed, and so on September 22, 1862, Lincoln issued the Emancipation Proclamation, which says, "All persons held as slaves within the rebellious states are, and henceforward, shall be free." Now, there's some caveats to that. The freedom was not due to commence until January 1st of 1863, and kind of weirdly, the proclamation only applied to the states that were in active rebellion. It didn't apply, for example, to the slave states that were still part of the Union, like Maryland and Kentucky. Also, it didn't apply to the areas that were at that time already captured by the North. So if you were a slave in Virginia, in a part of Virginia that was still part of the Confederacy, you were free, on paper anyway. But if you were a slave in a part of Virginia that was already captured by the Union forces, you weren't free. Or if you were a slave just across the border to the North in Maryland, you were still a slave. If you were a slave in a captured part of Virginia or Tennessee, you were still a slave. You're only freed if you were a slave in a state that was no longer part of the United States. And thus, because you're in another state that's not part of the United States at the moment, you're technically not under the jurisdiction of a U.S. president's proclamation. So, the Emancipation Proclamation didn't actually free any of the slaves. It just proclaimed that the slaves in what was sort of a totally separate country were now free. It's like if the U.S. just today proclaimed that all of the people in Canada don't have to pay any more taxes. The people in government of Canada would just say, "Eh? Okay." And they would keep going about their business and keep paying 70% income tax or whatever it is they pay up there. The Emancipation Proclamation didn't apply to anyone that was in the jurisdiction of the actual North. So it didn't actually free any slaves. But it did have a big effect. It made it clear that this was what the Civil War was really all about. It made it clear in both the North and the South that the point of all this fighting and all this dying was to force the South to free the slaves. It wasn't effective at all as a legal measure, but it was effective as propaganda. And once the North did begin occupying new Southern territory after the beginning of 1863, the slaves in those areas were indeed formally free. And after the war was over, the 13th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution formally made slavery anywhere in the United States illegal, which honestly, that should have been done in the original Bill of Rights. Like Lincoln said, if slavery isn't wrong, then nothing is wrong. After the Emancipation Proclamation, the war continued. But now it was sort of formally about ending slavery. And this also helped the Union, in that now both England and France felt like they could help and support the North, since both of those countries, England and France, had already outlawed slavery. They didn't entirely stop helping the South, but the British and French governments formally began to actively help the North. After the Battle of Antietam and the Emancipation Proclamation, the momentum of the entire Civil War did shift. We're about to get to two of the biggest battles of the war, one of which was even bigger than Antietam and more costly. Join me next episode for the battles of Vicksburg and Gettysburg.